All right, we're in Ecclesiastes. Last week we looked at the preamble to Ecclesiastes, and this week we'll pick up in middle of chapter 1 and go through chapter 2. The thesis, as we looked at last week, is given in the second verse. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Or if you want to use the word meaningless, but it's, you know, just there's no substance. There's no substance to life is basically what he ends up saying. It's just, you know, it's not a very, definitely not an optimistic outlook as he gives that meaning. In verse 3, I really give this overall question that probably has influence all the way through the book. He says, what advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? And there's two things there. That idea of work is this sense of labor, toiling. But also it's what's done under the sun. And so we're looking at this horizontal plane. That's one of the major keys here is this separation, as it's presented here, is looking at life from a human viewpoint. If all there is to life is what you see, and he's saying, what advantage, what benefit, how does it profit you? And his bottom line is, it really doesn't. The attitude is, you know, is in regard to making a lasting impression upon this earth. You know, human endeavor, in, you know, is fleeting and inconsequential in the final analysis. As we move to the next section, it's really examining this whole attitude. Does one's labor really have an advantage? If anyone had an advantage, surely it would have been Solomon. You know, if getting ahead is the name of the game, so to speak, then surely Solomon was in an advantageous position to win that game. And that's kind of where this goes. This first section, first section of what we're going to look at, but it'd be the very last of chapter 1, 12 through 18, we could title it as Limits to Wisdom. Limits to Wisdom. He says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. And then in verse 13, he, having given us that introduction, he gives us this sense of a kind of a scope of what his adventure is. He says, I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. So a little different term, but basically the same thing. Here it says under heaven. Other times it says, you know, under the sun. But basically the same concept. And he says, I set my mind to seek and explore. Seek here is that idea of seeking with care, to inquire. Explore is a word that occurs in Numbers, it's almost always in the sense of the spies. So it's that sense of exploring, spying. But in the sense of an Ecclesiastes, it's a kind of a careful examination, which in some sense that's what a spy does. You're going in and carefully examining things. But here it's a careful examination. It's the, you know, it's that intense search for wisdom. It's a preoccupation that he has. And so Solomon's saying, you know, I set out to explore, to research, to discover what it is, you know, about wisdom concerning anything on this level. So, you know, when we think about wisdom, sometimes we think of it almost in that connection with God, that you know, that whole aspect of how life works, and in regard to that there's a divine being. And so you have to kind of separate that aspect of wisdom here, because wisdom is not being viewed in this regard as that there's a God. It's being viewed just on a horizontal plane, but it's still that sense of wisdom of you know, being wise, of being prudent, you know, what makes life work. Which is important here, because that's his pursuit. He's pursuing this sense of how does life work. He moves on, and there's a general statement that life is a struggle. It's a struggle to the very end, and in the very end, you can conclude that it's just futile. The last part of verse 13, it says, it is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. That's life. Life is just this grievous task, and you're afflicted with it. And he moves in the next two verses, it continues in verse 14, I'm sorry. He says, I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. And that striving after the wind would be in the sense of chasing after wind, trying to somehow grab hold of it. So it's just another way of saying it's, it's all futile. And so he says, God has afflicted us with this sense of life, and he's looked at everything in life, everything done under the sun, and in the bottom analysis, it's all meaningless. It's all just like chasing wind. And then he illustrates this with a proverb in verse 15. It says, what is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. And it's kind of like these paradoxes in life. It's almost as though we're always trying to straighten what is crooked and trying to count what's not there. Now, the sense of straighten what's crooked, our initial thoughts might be to disagree with that and say, well, things can be straightened. You can even take, boards that are warped and shave the edges off if it's thick enough to get wood that, is usable for, you can take metal and heat it. And, so there's various things that can be straightened. Roads, in some sense, can be straightened by redoing the road. But in many regards, things that are crooked, they're just crooked. You cannot straighten them. But clearly, things that aren't there, you can count. You can have, unknown to you, be six eggs in the hen house, and the fox comes in and takes three of them. When you get out there, all you're going to count is three. You're not going to count the three that aren't there. you just can't count what's there. But it's that sense of a paradox of life that that it's just always there. It's almost as saying, there's this life is this refusing to accept the reality of what it is, this unhappiness and weariness in life. 16 and 17, as he moves on, it's this acknowledgement that there is wisdom, and wisdom has a value. But yet, having said that, wisdom is not something that can really be grasped and held on to and controlled. It's somewhat elusive in that regard. He says, I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I realized that this also is striving after the wind. And so there's a value to it, but there's a limit to that value. And then in verse 18, this we're in chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes, verse 18. And we come back to this paradox, proverb here that's showing this paradox of good and useful, such as wisdom is good and useful, but yet it's, within life is intermingled with sorrow and grief. He says, because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. It's not so much that he's, he's saying that if you're wise, that there's going to be grief, that the wisdom leads to grief, or that if you have knowledge, that leads to pain. It's just that you can have wisdom and knowledge, and it doesn't separate you from the grief and the pain. And so it, there's a value to it, but it's limited. In the next chapter, in chapter 2, he moves on, and it's here looking more in the sense of the limits of pleasure and possessions. And so, as Solomon is pursuing all this thing, there is that pursuit of wisdom, of understanding, of knowledge. But now he moves in this area of saying, well, let's just explore pleasures. Let's just explore possessions. And so one can enjoy life as it goes about working and accumulating, but in the end, not a single penny will be possessed by the person. So there's that limit. You can gain all of this, but death ultimately becomes this obstacle that stands in the way, ultimately of really ultimately achieving anything. So if obtaining is a profit, is some type of profit, and that's the goal of achieving, then it's never truly gained. I said to myself, come now, in verse 1 of chapter 2, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself, and behold, it too was futility. It too was meaningless. So the one that follows may obtain, but in the end, you really don't succeed. It's kind of... there's these experiments. But as we'll see, and you can even see in verse, 9, the last part of 9, he says, my wisdom also stood by me. As we're talking about him pursuing pleasure and possessions, gaining possessions, it's not in this hedonistic sense. It's not just all morality is thrown aside. There's this sense of wisdom here. So it's exploring pleasures, exploring possessions, but it's there is a certain sense of a restraint here. It's not a Hugh Hefner, lifestyle that he's talking about when he says this. But he says, I said of laughter, verse 2, it is madness, and in a pleasure, what does it accomplish? So there's this rhetorical question here. Because there's no real lasting accomplishment. So you can talk about laughter, you can talk about pleasure, but in the bottom line, what does it accomplish? Because nothing lasts. And so he was very intent on testing the effects of pleasure, seeking pleasure and frivolous things to see if they really were worthwhile. but it's not done with reckless abandonment. And so in verse 3, he says, I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine, while my mind was guiding me wisely. So it's not drunkenness that's in view here, but the exploring the pleasures of wine. So almost would be in the sense of wine tasting, or tasting different kinds of wines, or drinking different things that to seek this pleasure. But he says, that he did it, with his, to stimulate his body, but he was doing it with his mind guiding him wisely. Until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. Verse 5, I made gardens and parks for myself, and I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. So he looks at all this expansive building, architectural kinds of things. And anything you can think of that you could build to make beautiful, whether it's gardens or whether it's fountains, irrigation for his forest, he did all these things to have enjoyment, to gain pleasure. And most people appreciate aesthetics. They appreciate beautiful landscapes. And people drive around. And where we lived in Brenham, when we moved to Brenham, 70% of the county was owned by Houston residents. This is future retirement. This is where they come on the weekend to build their retirement home. That's what they do on the weekends. They come out there and they build it. And this one couple that attended our church, in their house, when they were driving around, Tony was telling us, the realtor's actually showing them other land, and Tony sees this land, and he says, that's what I want right there. The landscape, it's just what he wanted. I want my house up here on this hill. I want to be able to see that. And it's, so people appreciate that. People and within Tulsa, you have various gardens, and people enjoy going there. Well, that's what Solomon pursued, saying this will give meaning to life. He ends up saying, it was just meaningless in that regard of giving real, true meaning. He surrounded himself with fine things. In verses 7 and 8 says, I bought male and female slaves, and I had home-born slaves. Also, I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold, and the treasures of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers, and the pleasures of men, many concubines. You know, so just pursuing these pleasures in different ways of possessions, you know, maybe having the largest flock of sheep in the world, that'll make me happy. You know, it's this type of pursuits. And then in verse 9 and 10, there is this sense of accomplishments. He says, "Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. And all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, and my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor." So there was a sense of accomplishment. And in that temporal sense, there is that point where I've got the biggest flock out here. I've done this, I've done this. There's a reward, but the reward is right there, right now. And while there was this enjoyment, in verse 11, you know, basically says, but there's no ultimate gain. And while there was this reward, there's really no ultimate gain. Thus I considered all my activities which my hand had done, and the labor which I exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after the wind, and there was no profit under the sun. And so with that great sense of accomplishment, you know, when he gets through and analyzing, he says, but what does it mean? What does it really mean? He says, it's nothing. There are few, in my opinion, very few statements in sports by athletes that really have been remarkable. Two, I don't really know the exact quote on one of them. I just know the general thing that he said was way back in the 60s, Don Meredith, that was the quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys, in response to people talking about the game, he says, you know, it's just a game. It's just a game. And everybody tends to start thinking about all that differently. And, you know, this is what life's about. And Meredith's out there going, it's just a game. The other one was Dwayne Thomas, who is very much at that time period, though he'd be very calm now compared to the way people act. But at that time period, he was very much a rebel as a member of the Dallas Cowboys. And they had this very strict dress code. Everybody had to wear a tie. And so he would put it around his neck, just draped around his neck because it was required to wear a tie. So that was wearing the tie. And he did not talk to the press. Dallas won the Super Bowl. And Dwayne Thomas was the first person to rush for 100 yards in the Super Bowl. And he hadn't talked to the press in, you know, weeks, months. And after the game, the question to him was, what's it like to play in the ultimate game? And here's this guy that's basically viewed as an idiot. He doesn't talk, and there's nothing about him that seems like he's very intelligent. And he said, if it's the ultimate game, why are they playing it next year? And, you know, you listen to all the hype that's going on about sports, here we're coming on the Super Bowl, and, you know, New England's going to be the greatest team of all time, and it will last until the Super Bowl's over. You know, give it a week after the Super Bowl, and, yeah. I mean, Indianapolis won the Super Bowl last year, but it means absolutely nothing right now. And it's that sense, that's what Solomon's looking at. It's, I've accomplished this, but when I step back, it has no ultimate meaning. moves on in the next section. You know, having talked about wisdom at the end of chapter 1, this really is reflecting one more time on the limits of wisdom, and it brings in some other aspects in verse 12 and following, 12 through 16. In verse 12, it's kind of following that same thing about talking about the Super Bowl, because it's that you know, one may obtain, but nobody can really ever exceed this. And that's what Solomon's looking at right now. He says, you know, I've obtained all this, but the one that comes after me, they may obtain it, but they're not going to exceed this. And so it's kind of where, the Giants or the Patriots are going to win the Super Bowl, but when they win the Super Bowl, what they've done is accomplish what 40 other teams have done. It's you know, they can can do that, and it's accomplishing something now, but somebody next year is going to win it also. In verse 12 he says, "So I turned to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. For what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done?" So somebody else can come along and accomplish this, but all they're going to do is be doing what's already been done. In verse 13, he's once again acknowledging that there's these benefits to wisdom, and his pursuits and pleasure are, you know, guided by wisdom, not just hedonism. He says, "And I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness." So there is this benefit. I mean, it's better to be wise than be a fool. And there's benefits to being wise as there are deficits to being a fool. And continues in verse 14 and showing that, well, you know, if you're wise, you avoid traps. And so there's benefit. The fool's going to fall into them. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I know that one fate befalls them both. And that's where he turns in this last part, acknowledging there's a benefit to wisdom. It's better to be wise than be a fool. But then, ultimately, both the wise and the fool die. So is there any ultimate value in being wise? No. There's these temporal values. It's more enjoyable. There's you avoid some of these traps, but how frustrating, as Solomon looks at it. When I get to the end, the fool and I are both going to die. And the last part of verse 14, "And yet I know that one fate befalls them both. Then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it also it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity, this too is meaningless, this too is basically pointless." So there's value to wisdom. He's acknowledging there's value to wisdom. But ultimately, what's the value? Ultimately, what's the value? I mean, you know, just think about that in terms of just life on a horizontal plane. That if all there is to this life is right here and now, then the person that's able to acquire things that makes them enjoy life is, you know, has an advantage over the person that isn't able to enjoy life. And so there's advantages. So if you're able to avoid the trap, then there's an advantage. You can enjoy life more. But when you get to the very end of it, ultimately, whatever you got out of life is what you got out of life, because it's over. There's nothing really there. There's no real meaning. And so if you focus on each day, then you can enjoy your existence. But if you view it from a broader perspective, then it's pretty dismal. There really isn't any meaning just on looking at life under the sun. In the next section, verses 17 to 26, he really moves from looking at this despair, because you can see how it's moving toward despair, and so it really ends up in that despair. But then he moves from despair into the sense of satisfaction. So it takes an interesting twist here. But in verse 17, he said, "I said to myself, God will judge both." Oh, man, I thought that doesn't sound right. I jumped to the wrong chapter here. So I hated life, for the work which he had been done under the sun was grievous, because everything is futile and striving after the wind. Yeah. So if you just think about, you know, if life is just horizontal and you're able to focus on each day gaining everything out of life that you want, then, you know, there's something enjoyable about life. But if you think of it on a broader perspective, you end up with, I really hate life. Because no matter what I accomplish, in the end, it has no real meaning. And so he ends up saying, I hate life. So he's pretty much in despair at this point. So ultimately, there's nothing worthwhile. You know, it's all meaningless. It's all chasing after a wind. In 18 through 21, he goes on kind of the idea that not only is life meaningless and repugnant, but he includes labor within all of this. That it's, you know, has that same sense of distaste. So the conclusion is that, you know, one really gets, all you get from labor is pain and stress, and it all amounts to meaninglessness. So in verse 18 he says, "Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me." And that's, you know, so I've acquired all this, I've accomplished all this, but somebody else is going to inherit it. Yeah. And that's what, you know, it goes on. "And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool." And see, so it would be bad enough from Solomon's perspective is when I die that my wise son will inherit it. That would be bad enough. Or some wise, you know, warrior will come along and take it over. Or some, you know, wise guy will come along and court my wife and inherit everything I have. That would be bad enough. But what's even worse is that it'll be some just idiot. "Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor, for which I have labored, by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. Therefore I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor, for which I had labored under the sun." You have to wonder, some of these people that, you know, give their money away, what? Why do they give their money away? I mean, we benefit from it. It's wonderful they do. But why do they sometimes? I think some of them are just really nice people. But also, some of it's that sense of, you know, there's going to be this lasting heritage. You know, people are going to remember me. There's going to be something out there. And you see some of these others, they evidently, I don't know, they're either crazy or some sense of despair, so they give all their money to, you know, to some cat. You know, some dog or something. And you know, so you have to wonder, is that a sense of despair? But he continues there. Verse 21, it says, "When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them. That's vanity." Not only that, it's an evil. So now it's moved beyond just that it's meaningless. It's meaningless. It's like, and something's wrong with it. It shouldn't be that way. 22 and 23, there's a conclusion that he really brings to it. It says that all one really gets from his labor is pain and stress. You know, all this is meaningless. "For what does a man get in all his labor and in his striving with which he labors under the sun? Because all his days his task is painful and grievous. Even at night his mind does not rest. This too is vanity." So even if you see benefit in labor of acquiring these things in pleasure, there was actually a lot of toil in it, a lot of painfulness, you know, a lot of work. And then there was this stress of being concerned about it and being preoccupied with it. And you don't even get to keep it in the end. And so he concludes, it's all vanity. So there's a real dark side that he's moved to. I mean, you know, it started off pretty dark because it's very pessimistic, but it's moved to be even deeper and darker at that point. But then there's this little twist that takes place here, which is one of these little bright spots we get to see in Ecclesiastes, and there are not a lot of them. But, you know, as because it you know, just mainly just keeps building toward this despair and showing you how, you know, looking at life, and then at the end gets to this aspect of God. But here we see this other glimpse. In 24 he says, "There is nothing better for man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God." And so there's this introduction of God here in a different aspect than we've seen before. "For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? For to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner, he has given the task of gathering and collecting, so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight. So he may give to one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity in striving after the wind. So here he's looking at that, you know, since there's no lasting value in one's labor, a person should enjoy the fruits here and now. So eating and drinking is a figurative way of saying to partake of you know, the fruits of life. And so here one finds a measure of satisfaction with their life. But he concludes that there's a proper perspective of God in all this. That when you have that proper perspective of God, it makes all the difference. The enjoyment of one's labor is a provision from God. So Solomon is looking at the rewards of here. This is not really like a sense of eternal rewards, but here on earth. But if there's a perspective, then there can be this measure of enjoyment of life. Without it, then it's all just hopelessness. So it is the humble things received as gifts from God, you know, the eating, the drinking, and the finding satisfaction in one's work, where joy is to be found. The good life is the life centered on God and on and not on the, you know, striving self. So, a little twist here that he looks at this perspective that when there's a perspective, when you see that these things come from God, that there is a God, then there is some, enjoyment in life. You know, so when it's all said and done, it's the person who has done, you know, kind of the ordinary things well that actually, you know, accomplishes something that accumulates some profit, so to speak, rather than one that sacrifices those things to try to scheme for something great. So what are your thoughts here on the end of this? Any thoughts?
Well, assuming this is Solomon, you know, we've seen his life, you know, he became king, you know, he started out wise, became king, and, you know, the beginning of chapter 2 pretty much describes the things that he did, you know, that were seen as kind of the unwise ruler. You know, he was a great ruler, but he did some stupid things and sort of repented as he aged. But if this is Solomon, it's almost saying that he did all those things out of his wisdom to see if they would be enjoyable. Kind of.
I think in this part, there's more of it than that. Often, and I've heard it presented that, you know, all the hedonistic lifestyle that Solomon was pursuing, that's what Ecclesiastes is about. But this section really doesn't suggest this. It's more of this investigating life under the sun. So I think that's, yeah.
Well, that's sort of what I'm trying to get at. It almost sounds like he's discounting, you know, or maybe even in retrospect, saying, I did those things to explore wisdom.
Well, I think if it was that, then he wouldn't be being honest with himself. So, yeah. If that's the reference, he would definitely not. It wouldn't be an honesty.
Of course,
I think
he did those things twice.
Yeah. Well, but I think, you know, here it's not so much the things that are being described aren't really in the sense of sin. Though, I mean, in one sense, it'd be hard to say they're not when you're saying everything focuses on self. But, yeah, which is a hard one always with the Old Testament. It's definitely wrong, but seems to be somehow on a different plane, which is hard to really fathom from a New Testament perspective. But this is not, you know, what he's describing here isn't so much an abandonment of all that's moral to just go, you know, enjoy life, so to speak, but more an investigation into what makes life work and what has meaning. And he ends up saying, under the sun, nothing has meaning. Yes, and then you come, and that's what these little verses here at the end of the chapter are really refreshing here, because it shifts and says, but there is this, he's not looking in the eternal sense at this point, but but on this on earth, that there is this enjoyment. There is some sense of enjoyment in life if you have a this perspective of God. Right. I think you definitely, there is that, it's twofold. You could also, I was focusing on the other, but definitely focus on that. Because he, you know, all of a sudden, you know, earlier we were talking about the full and wisdom, you know. But here we end up with, if you would, the godly and the sinner. I mean, it's switched all of a sudden. And as you're saying, there is this sense of judgment. Yeah. Yeah, because that's really a switch from what he was saying earlier about I've acquired all this and then just some fool's going to get my stuff. And here it's you know, this other sense that there's something there. And but I think, you know, while Ecclesiastes is definitely hard to understand on certain levels, on other levels at certain places, it's real easy to see broad applications, perhaps. It may be hard to take specific verses and say, I don't know if I exactly know what that means and where does that apply. But in the general, you know, broader sense, it becomes real easy to see, okay, that's you know, Western civilization. It's about, you know, what's the old cliche, you know, who has the most toys at the end of life wins. And that's, you know, there's a lot of truth in that, truth in the sense of that's the perspective, the philosophy that the Western world operates with. And so you have these people, you know, acquiring. And what do you do at the end when you've acquired all this? And so, you know, people set up, you know, grants, they set up stuff and they have their names on those to, you know, build buildings and put their names on them. There's some sense of there's got to be more. You know, I mean, just to think about that I've lived my life and I've accomplished these things and I've enjoyed it, that doesn't seem to be enough. It's, yeah, there needs to be something that has some lasting meaning. And even if that lasting meaning, if you looked historically, would be maybe at best 100 years or so that it'll be there. And what's so interesting is along those lines is, foundations. You know, we often have that association, but sometimes universities and things that are named after people that you have no clue. You know, you go there, your students. Unless you go find the plaque, nobody has any clue to who gave the money, who those people are, what the connection is. And it's there, there's a auditorium at Dallas Seminary called Lamb Auditorium, and the only reason I know anything about that auditorium is I know somebody that is a part of that family. And that's when it was because of that I learned this connection that, you know, that they gave the money to build that. But, you know, you just don't have those kinds of things very often. And so it's kind of that sense of where do you really get meaning? And so people look for meaning. People look for meaning all the time in various ways. But yet if you let yourself really think about it, then you're kind of lost as, well, what is meaning? This is a commentary that I've been reading. I told Robin that, you know, I've read, you know, two chapters of it, and he's quoted from The Simpsons three times. And I said, I've never watched it. I said, I'm going to have to rethink about, you know, watching The Simpsons. You know, this guy's quoted from him three times, you know. One quote he was saying, and I don't know any of the characters, but somebody was talking to somebody, this guy, you know, it's kind of presented as this very, 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 very rich guy. And the very rich guy says, because which one of the Simpsons is talking to him, saying, you know, kind of, all you have and all this kind of stuff. And the guy says, yes, but I would give it all for more. So that's kind of the Simpsons twist on the Rockefeller, huh? So I would give it all for more. Interesting. That's an interesting one. Are there any prayer requests?